The Feudal Future Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Feudal Future Podcast. I'm your co-host, Marshall Toplansky, and today it is the first time that we've done our podcast in front of a live audience. Thank you, audience. Thank you all for being here. We are kicking off a new series today on the 2024 elections and the different implications of different topics within it. Today, we're going to be talking about foreign policy and have an amazing panel to talk to us about that and engage in a really interesting dialogue. And to moderate the conversation, my co-host, Joel Kotkin. Joel?
Thank you very much. What we're going to do is, this is going to be very informal. Basically, we want to ask a lot of questions on a lot of different levels. We'll start off just to introduce our panelists, and I'm going to do it. I'm not going to tell everything that these people have done because we'd be here for a week. But Ron Spogli, who's a great friend of this university, and is the co-chairman of Freeman Spogli, which is one of the major private equity groups in LA. And he was the US ambassador to Italy, actually lives part of the year in Italy. And so we really wanted Ron to, you know, give us some of the perspective of NATO and what's going on in Europe. Ashwin Raghun is a native of Africa, as it turns out, not from India originally, but obviously of Indian descent. And he was the former head of innovation and CIO with ICANN. In other words, he controlled the internet, so you can blame him. Rob Kep, who's here at Chapman as well, is a director of the Asia Pacific Geoeconomics and Business Initiative. And is very well informed on issues involved with East Asia, not just China, but also Japan and South Korea. And obviously, there are a lot of points that we're going to be able to get into. And then Luke Nichter, again, also at Chapman, who is a professor of history, occupies the James Kavanaugh Endowed Chair in Presidential Studies, and is also the director of the Presidential Studies Program at Chapman. And this is really going to be the first part of a cooperation between the Center for Demographics and Policy and the Presidential Studies Program. And obviously, I have given who the candidates are going to be. Unfortunately, we have a presidential election this year. It's obviously going to be very painful. But we're going to try to make some sense out of it. So I'd like to just start off a little bit with Luke, who has a historical background, and really, you know, historically, we always had this old saying from Tip O'Neill, you know, all politics is local, and of course, you know, have the famous Bill Clinton line, is the economy stupid? Is foreign policy going to be a major issue this year, and if so, in what form? So, Luke?
Well, thanks. It's great to be here, and I think at the outset I will be transparent with the audience and say I struggle to make sense of the past. I certainly can't make sense of the present, and here we are talking about the future, what happens between now and November. But I think it's a valid question, and the question is really how many elections does foreign policy determine the result? How many elections does foreign policy make even a significant difference? How many elections does foreign policy drive voter turnout? I think these are things that we're all interested in, and I think a lot of the times the answer is not much, or at least it's not decisive. And so the question in 2024 is it going to be different this year? Is we're looking around the world, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Hamas and Israel and all the issues that we're here to talk about, immigration in a sense is a foreign policy issue in addition to a domestic policy issue. Is this year different, I think, is what we're here to talk about.
And do you get any sense from what you've seen so far that the only place I've seen the Israel issue come up is really in Michigan? Do you think it's going to affect the policy? Or is there the other question is President Biden, given an impossible situation and is sort of stuck in it? You know, the way presidents were captured by Vietnam, for instance.
I think frequently, especially in the academic world, you have scholars of domestic policy, you have scholars of foreign policy, and they're very siloed, and they don't necessarily understand what the other does. I think this is a case where the two are very closely connected in the sense that I think at least for the incumbent, for President Biden, a lot of these foreign policy issues are not natural issues for him this year. And so sometimes the strategy with foreign policy is to discuss it as little as possible, you know, is actually to your advantage. So I think there's different ways of looking at it. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio. So part of this whole Southeast Michigan area was a few minutes away. I grew up a suffering Detroit Tigers fan, a Detroit sports fan. And so I'm very familiar with that part of the country. It's a big issue. It's certainly a big issue in pockets of the country and in certain regions. Does that translate to a broader movement? I think we haven't seen yet.
And then obviously one of the Israel and Hamas is one of the major flashpoints. But for us in the West Coast, I think maybe the most significant thing is what's going to happen with China and Taiwan. We have very close ties here in Orange County to Taiwan. You know, if you go to Diamond Jamboree, a lot of those restaurants are Taiwanese entrepreneurs. We obviously have a strong technical involvement. What do you think is going to happen in terms of the, you know, it hasn't really been discussed very much, but, you know, what the implications of a possible invasion of Taiwan or intimidation of Taiwan?
So in terms of just even things remaining as they are, which is what everyone hopes, there seems to be consensus within U.S. policy circles, and that's left and right, that Taiwan needs more support, right? So there's, and on top of that, that there needs to be more vigilance against China. So we've been talking about it both amongst the panelists here over lunch, and you keep seeing in the headlines what's going on with TikTok, for example. And that's the one thing that's really unified both sides of the aisle in Congress in a way that we haven't seen before. When they had the kind of interrogatory sessions on TikTok where the CEO was hauled in, I mean, it was surprising the unanimity on being against what TikTok represents. And I would just further add to that, I think, yes, TikTok does pose a national security risk, whether or not the current solution that's been offered, which is to make ByteDance, its parent company, divest it, is the solution. I'm not sure. But I would say it would be interesting if we had the same sort of attention to social media in general, because I would say as a threat to the American polity, that still pertains. It's just, you know, Facebook isn't controlled ultimately by the Chinese Communist Party. But I think that simply things remaining as they are, you're going to see this high level of tension between the U.S. and China. I don't see that abating. It's the one thing that unifies both parties. In terms of what that should also mean, then, is more support for Taiwan. And we'll see if more is done with that. Part of what it hasn't been discussed so much with the Ukraine bill being held up is support for Taiwan has also been stalled. But I think more than Ukraine, actually, you see, once again, China is a galvanizing force in U.S. foreign policy. At least it has been, at least since the Trump administration in particular. It was becoming an item of concern under Obama. But now, and Biden has just perpetuated the same trade policies and basic stance towards China that Trump had, just a little bit more friendly. So if there is an actual invasion, to the heart of your question, it would be interesting to see what the U.S. does. It can do everything from provide logistics and material support to actual, you know, engagement, which is the big question and what people tend to fear. My own supposition is, one, there won't be an invasion, and two, should an invasion happen, it would probably be more in the area of support. We don't actually have a treaty with Taiwan, which makes any sort of direct support, direct military engagement difficult. But it could go to that because, again, the sentiment against China is so strong and for Taiwan also strong that you could actually see U.S. Kinetic involvement.
So obviously this would be catastrophic for the world economy, given Taiwan's incredibly important role in technology in particular. Now, I'm going to go back on the internet to Ashwin, but I would like to start initially as the one country you never hear about in foreign policy discussions is India, which is clearly going to be the next great superpower. And And as we were discussing over lunch, Ashwin is originally from South Africa, after India, Africa, and yet we don't deal with this in foreign policy at all. What's the role of India? How do you see that unfolding? What's the terms of the relationship with the U.S.? Because there's been a lot of tension over the years between the U.S. and India.
Yeah, indeed. I'm going to take this as an opportunity to comment on all three questions. So I'm going to start with Taiwan for starters, and then I'm going to go to India, and then I want to talk about local politics. Everything is local politics. So if you think of Taiwan, there are multiple areas of interest for the United States with regard to Taiwan. One of the primary ones is technological. We are a technology-dominated society right now, and the future is being crafted with artificial intelligence. And the source of that, the engine for artificial intelligence, is almost entirely and uniquely produced on the island of Taiwan by one company called TSMC. If we lose that supply chain, our technological future is at stake. This is not new news. This was foreseen at least 10 years ago. And the cognoscenti in the semiconductor industry, yours truly included, have been pounding the desk saying we need to do something from a policy perspective. That has resulted in a couple of things. One is a raising of awareness in the political circles in DC, and therefore we're starting to see some action on that front with the understanding that losing that supply chain will be catastrophic. The second is pressure on TSMC to diversify their investments outside of the nation-state borders of Taiwan. So we're seeing investments happen in Germany and also in the United States by Taiwan, by TSMC. But it'll be years before these facilities are up and running. And one of the most interesting outcomes of their willingness to invest has been that we, as much as we claim to be technologically superior, do not have trained labor to operate the factory that's now being built in Phoenix. This requires about 4,000 people, very high-paying jobs. The minimum salary in that facility will be $100,000. But we don't have the people with the training necessary, 4,000 of them. It's not like we need 4 million of them. We do not have 4,000 trained personnel to make this factory operational. So this is a very sad commentary on the state of education in this country and the lack of vision of what it takes to actually build the things that we need ourselves. So that's point number one. Point number two is clearly there is an ideological difference between the way Taiwan is regarded from Beijing vis-a-vis it's regarded from DC. And there's a lot of rhetoric. It's in everybody's best interest to keep this conversation going as opposed to having a confrontation of any nature. Because there is no end state where everybody is going to be happy. And it's a kind of weird twist of fate that the two companies that make the chips that make AI happen both happen to be Taiwanese. Jensen Huang in NVIDIA is from Taiwan. And the lady, May, who runs AMD, is his third cousin, also from Taiwan. Surprise, surprise. So this is really weird. It's all kind of mixed up, right? So there are a lot of reasons why we need to keep these things separate and straight in our heads and also make sure that we don't get to a confrontation state. There is no end game that can be gamed out today where there is happiness at the end of an engagement. And we also know from history that when we engage, our exit strategies are rarely, if ever, clear. So we don't know when we're done. All we do is we abruptly shut down and withdraw. That's what we've done repeatedly over the last 75 years, no matter where we've engaged. So that's as far as the Taiwan question is concerned. Going to India. India is a very unique nation with 1.5 billion people on the ascendant as a result of a lot of things that have occurred in history, not least a very strong education system that has resulted in a large and growing population that is extremely well educated and English literate, and therefore able to engage with what is considered to be the West. And from an ideological perspective, as a democracy, it is more aligned with this nation state than most other countries that have a large population. From a geographic perspective, its location is such that it can be a counter, it can be a counterbalance to China. If China is regarded as a threat, India is regarded as a counterweight to that threat. Now, China has its own strategies to surround India with what is known as a string of pearls in the Beijing speak, which is to have a series of countries that are China-friendly to contain India. The U.S. has had a counter move with what's known as the Quad, with Australia, Japan, India, and the U.S. to surround China and contain Chinese activity. The Quad has not been talked about until quite lately, when there has been a request from South Korea saying, why don't we make it into from a Quad to a fivesome? Let's also be a part of this, because we also regard the same threats as the Quad do from China as a threat to ourselves. So I think this game is being played out in real time. The problem right now is that the focus, the world's attention, is on Ukraine and in the Middle East, and it's not quite there yet. There's no spark. There's no point that is sparking interest there yet. But all it takes is one spark, and suddenly we'll be spread too thin. We'll be thinking about three different fronts. As it is, I think we're stretched with two fronts to think about, leave alone to fund, if worse yet, kinetically engage. We would be stretched beyond breaking point. So I don't think it's a very good idea at all to get Taiwan in the mix and China in the mix. I think just having it be comfortably moving along, let's face it, China's got plenty of problems of their own right now. Domestically, their unemployment rates in the below 30 range is somewhere in the 35 to 40%. They've got all kinds of structural capital issues. You know, Evergrande is only the tip of the iceberg. They're talking about $1 trillion worth of real estate crashing down without the ability to refinance. They have plenty of problems. So we should just let them deal with the problems and not provoke anything in that regard. The last thing that I wanted to comment is the first question that you posed, and that is all politics retail? I believe so. Look, this next election, from my perspective, is going to get decided with somewhere between 700,000 and 4 million votes in probably nine constituencies. Is it important in those nine constituencies? You betcha. It's going to be retail politics in those nine constituencies. And when you game it out, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you know which constituencies are these nine. And in those constituencies, the swing vote is going to be the minorities, however you define the minorities. And if you're able to capture the imagination of the minorities, then we will have one outcome versus the other. Who's going to be successful in doing that is the only game that's left in town. The rest of this is Strom and Drang, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. And I want to ask Ron, because first of all, he actually was part of the administration, and you know, I'm sure has had these discussions at the State Department during the presidency of President Bush. What the Ukraine seems to be almost being forgotten in all our emphasis, particularly on the Palestine-Israel conflict. What do you think the effect of the of Ukraine will be on the election, on foreign policy in general? I noticed this morning that the Pope was calling for a ceasefire, basically, you know, doing what Hamas probably would like. Where are we going with this? I mean, are the Europeans really ready to step up? What should we be doing? And will this be a domestic political issue?
Right. So let me start with a more general commentary, going back to what Luke was talking about, which is it really going to matter this time? Because I think your question flows out of the fact that the assumption is that it will matter to people what's happening in Ukraine or in the Middle East. I would like to think that it can matter, it should matter, but I'm not so certain it will matter. And I'm not so sure it will matter for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is domestic politics, as we talked about, normally have a very significant impact on the election. And this year, domestically, the current administration finds itself in somewhat difficult circumstances, not getting credit for the economy being what it is today, and however you may want to describe it, that unemployment is reasonably low. The growth rate has not turned negative for two quarters, and therefore we do not have a technical recession, which a number of people were predicting for 2024. But clearly, this administration is suffering from a perception that somehow people are worse off now than they were several years ago. I would argue that's probably due to inflation, where people recognize that their buying power has been eroded. So I think that the spotlight, however brightly it shines on domestic politics normally, is going to shine even more brightly, tending to vitiate, if you will, the focus on foreign policy. It should matter because Luke will know this substantially better than I will, but essentially the idea of seeing so many significant issues coalesce at the same time, I can't recall seeing it in my lifetime. You've got obviously the question of Ukraine-Russia. You've got the question of NATO in Europe. You have obviously Hamas in Israel. You have the question of Iran continuing to create mischief in the Middle East, and you have the China question. So these are five very fundamental questions which should get spotlight, but I don't know to what degree they really will going forward. Why has Ukraine not gotten the attention that it should have received? Well, for a number of reasons. The Democrats, by and large, are for support of Ukraine. Donald Trump, obviously, is not so certain what he's in favor of, and certainly doesn't appear to be supporting Ukraine at this moment in time. NATO is another question, which obviously we believe, generally speaking, I think most Americans believe in the importance of key alliances. NATO has obviously been a bulwark of our security mechanisms from the end of World War II. And yet Donald Trump would, if not like to dismantle them, certainly he wants to extract a lot more participation by the Europeans, which I don't think anyone has issues with. The Europeans have been free riders for a long time as it relates to NATO. I can remember in 2005 sitting in Rome trying to encourage the Italians to spend more than their meager 0.75%. And it was not an easy proposition. At the same time, how that gets done is a fundamental question. I'm not so sure bludgeoning our European allies is the best way to approach their greater participation, but certainly there will be a lot of contrast that will be drawn there in the election. But as I say, I tend to believe that we may see less focus on foreign policy issues just because of the primacy of domestic concerns.
Well, maybe just to start, and then anybody, this is really, we'd like this to become just basically conversation among the four of you. But let's throw out, a scenario and get your reaction to it and how it would affect the presidential election and the presidency over time. Let's assume Donald Trump is elected. What does that do politically internally for the U.S., but also as we are perceived abroad? Anyone want to tackle that one?
I can start. It seems that we are in one of the worst situations that our founders ever imagined, which is anytime the president is in a political party that's different than the House of Representatives, we are in, I think, almost a near potential permanent impeachment scenario. Mm-hmm. So I think it seems that regardless of who wins, until we can get beyond this seesaw of close elections, until we have someone who actually has a decisive victory and has at least one chamber in Congress, I think we're going to continue in this seesaw. So I think in the short term, unless if Trump wins, unless he has at least one chamber of Congress, there's going to be absolute gridlock in Washington.
One thing I could say regarding Asia, at least, is, and picking up on Luke's point, I think that is interesting. I think in East Asia, I'll limit it to that, they are looking for decisiveness. Our Asia pivot, as we called it, goes back to the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And Obama and then Secretary of State Clinton, under his leadership, talked about this pivot. They had a mandate, but really didn't deliver. If you actually look at what happened once we announced the Asia pivot, China started militarizing the South China Sea. They ramped up to the level of real outright warfare, cyber attacks on everything from our businesses to social security system, so they could find out which spies of ours that the CIA barely had operating in country and execute them immediately. You know, you go on and on and on. And then there wasn't really this perceived warmth given to our allies like Japan and South Korea. And Singapore, I think, is one of the most underappreciated players in that mix that that we could do more with and just haven't. So in any case, I think what we're really in danger of is just further drifting away. We talk about doing more with Asia. We are a Pacific power. As you mentioned in your earlier remarks, Joel, you know, California is part of this Asia-Pacific rim. We have the demographics that support close ties. We actually, in fact, if anything, like what Ashwin was talking about, we have incredible corporate interaction. People-to-people and business interaction with Asia is largely good. Mm-hmm. It was just announced on, leaked, I should say, to Western media that a citizen journalist of a sort, a technopreneur who's got a beef against ByteDance. The chairman of ByteDance, who's also the head of the Chinese communist cell at ByteDance, has apparently, according to what looks like fairly verified evidence, two illegitimate children by another ByteDance executive living in San Marino and going to high school here. So even the communists like California, right? I mean, even they want to plant roots here. And that's always been an open secret within the inner circle of the Chinese leadership that as much as they've tried to eliminate, like Qingang, the foreign minister was dismissed largely for the same thing, having a lover who had birth of his son, an illegitimate son here in the United States, and they get U.S. citizenship, and so of course they're seen as compromised, and they totally go against the line, the official line that China is the new paradise and the ascending power and all this. So in fact, beneath the surface of the politics, there's a lot going on. If America could just do a little more to coordinate and align what we're doing with business and people at the government level, we would really claim a lot of influence in Asia. It's not that hard, except we don't have the political processes in place to do that yet.
Do you think it matters who wins and who doesn't for that?
Well, I'm going to take that. I think it matters a great deal. You know, I was reading just this last week, Freedom House does a survey of the state of democracy on a global basis, and it hasn't been lower in the last 50 years than right now. So if you think of historic arcs and you measure time in centuries, we moved in the last 120 years from what was a feudalistic society, sorry, no pun intended, to a more democratically oriented society where peoples decided what their form of government should be. And the question that I ask of myself is, was the interregnum between the end of the Second World War and the early part of this century a dream state that we suddenly found ourselves in, only to see what was prior reality reestablish itself with highly control-oriented central powers? Or is what we experienced the normal that we redefined as a global population, but we're now seeing an aberration of some sort and we'll get past again? I think that is the question. We don't know, and I think in 100 years' time we may be able to look back and reflect on what transpired, but right now it seems to be this very difficult tension that we are not unique in experiencing. Even other democracies supposedly are experiencing this. So think about this. I often offer two different examples in this regard. You think of democracy as defined by the European Union. There's the members of parliament in Brussels, the members of the European Parliament, 700 odd of them. But they have no powers until they go back to their member states and get whatever decision they make ratified by the member states. So effectively, they are functional bureaucrats in a bureaucracy that's very transnational. And unless a nation state decides to embrace and make their own a policy made in Brussels, it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot. It just means that the MEPs had a lot of discussion about something or the other. Imagine, for instance, the AI Act of Europe, which is offered by them as here is the way we ought to do something. Well, they have come to a conclusion in their discussion. It's not law in any land in Europe, not yet. And it won't be for the next many years because 28 of them have to agree that this is the law, as opposed to saying this is our law. So that's one example. The second is India. You think of India. India is a collection of states. It is not a nation to speak of because there are very few things that are Indian about India. Every region is different culturally, linguistically. Their foods are different. Their observations of the same festivals are interpreted differently. On the same exact day of the month, the north of India will be celebrating something that's totally different from the south of India, but it happens to be a common day that something completely different is being observed. So there are very few unifying forces. You think of that as a democracy. At the center, there is no opposition today. By any definition of democracy, no opposition is not a democracy. And yet, nothing that is done at the center is effectively going to get implemented at the state level because practically every state in India has a party in position, in power, that is not aligned with the Bharatiya Janata Party or the BJP, which is at the center. So there is tremendous opposition. So it's all a matter of interpretation. So it really matters what the outcome of this next election is going to be here, because that's going to define whether this grand arc of history is going to get reinforced with the interregnum that we already experienced as a dream state, or whether the old hegemonies are going to be back in power and we tell ourselves that was a good dream while it lasted. So that, I think, is what we're going to see. So it matters.
Ron?
So, you know, our own role as the United States in the world, I don't think is always appreciated. And maybe it's least appreciated by Americans. The Italians with whom I interacted for 3.5 years would often say to me, you know, you have a special place in the world. The United States is the only indispensable nation. Because if you're not organizing the world, it'll be the Russians or the Chinese. And so when they would be critical of what our particular policy might be, and I would encourage them to say, well, what do you want us to do in the circumstance? No, no, no. We want you to organize. We just want you to do it better. And so the notion was always that we had a special responsibility that they didn't want to give to anyone else because effectively there was no one else. And so this notion, this neo notion of isolationism as the answer, I don't think it's particularly well informed. I think it's difficult for the values which we have come to want to spread around the world of liberty, of democracy, of market-based economies. I think it's very difficult to have those flourish without the United States being in a position of leadership and where its word is believed. And I think one of the things that we've done great disservice to, and we can point to many examples of it, and I would simply point to recently a very hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan. I'm not making a political commentary. I'm making an observation. Yeah. But we lose credibility when we do things like that, and we don't realize the importance of maintaining commitments. NATO has benefited the United States, it seems to me, infinitely more than it's benefited any country in Europe. And it's certainly benefited the countries in Europe by being able to keep the peace for 77, now 79 years in Europe, more or less. We have avoided having a third responsibility to come to the rescue of Europe. And so I think that when we put America first, if you want to take a Trumpian view of the fact that we needed to put the United States first, supporting NATO is a great example of putting the United States first. So I think to have another interpretation just doesn't read history properly.
So are you saying that you're a Republican who's skeptical about Trump?
Well, he's not a Republican. I don't know what he is. He's running on the Republican side, but he's certainly not a Republican. Yeah, yeah. But you make a good point, and that is, I don't know what a Republican Party means anymore either, because the traditional elements of a Republican Party, strong national defense, supporting international allies, balanced budgets, those things have largely, I think, been eclipsed. Now, whether they're momentary or not remains to be seen, but certainly for the next period of time here, and especially if he becomes president, they are going to be the dominant policy of the Republican Party. But I don't think those are long-term sustainable principles for us to have. I understand that a lot of people who say supporting Ukraine is a very difficult thing to do. There are a lot of difficult things to do. It's not a choice of a great option versus a bad option. There are two very bad options, but one is better than the other, it seems to me, and you got to support that option.
Just a quick comment. I think what Ron's talking about also speaks to an inherent weakness in our system, where we're this champion of global democracy, yet compared to parliamentary democracies, we're this aberration. I mean, we're two parties. And so that's why you had this dissolution of the old Republican Party. It's been taken over by a populist who identified more democratic throughout his business career. And it's because there isn't a third party. I'm not trying to say anything radical. It's just an observation that, a fundamental flaw is that we don't have more party organization to allow a voice like that to get channeled somewhere and not destroy what had been a very responsible, pro-American agenda in a rational sense party.
Yeah, I would just add to Ron's point is that I think the American system in a way is a strength and a weakness. You know, the strength is that the United States continues to be in a unique position around the world. And that unique position is that the United States has a kind of moral authority that other potential leaders in the world don't have. And by that, I mean, since World War II, really the unique thing sort of in all of human history, sacrificing to rebuild our former enemies in Japan and Germany. And committing to NATO and multilateralism and, common defense and long-term treaties. I mean, no matter who wins, these are elements of the past that aren't going to go away and that we have to live with and figure out what that looks like in the post-Cold War and the 21st century. On the other hand, I assume by now foreign nations have awoken to the fact that if you wait long enough, the Americans will get tired and go home. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Taiwan mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. whether it's Korea or whether it's Vietnam, yeah. maybe Afghanistan belongs in that list, that I think, it really raises a question that you need support of the Americans. You need to actively engage them in the world and keep them tethered to the world, perhaps, Ron's example of NATO. But it's also very much the awareness that, I ask my students all the time, and I have some students in both of my classes here today, that the question is, what is, do we do big things anymore? What's the value? How much faith can other nations put in this country in terms of long-term treaty commitments? And I don't know the answer.
Any other on this?
Well, it raises a question, too. I think it's a very good point you make, and that is, to what degree should foreign policy, by its very nature, be a more bipartisan initiative? The State Department would always repeat the simple notion that, well, bipartisanship ends at the country's shores. Party politics ends at the country's shores. It's no longer the case, and it never was completely, but it was disproportionately so, it seems to me, for a long time. Now it's become part of the conversation with respect to how one wages a political campaign. And I think unless you have that continuity, as we were talking about earlier, it's difficult for the United States to have long-term credibility.
I think, Ron, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at it from the other perspective, so if you're a country on some other shore looking at the United States, I can remember as recently as 20 years ago that they regarded what is the United States position. Now they're having to regard it as what is the Republican position? What is the Democrat position? Yeah. And that is sad, because if the outcome of each election is determining how each of our partners has to view us in their front mirror, leave alone the rear view mirror, it's dangerous. We have become a danger to ourselves now.
True. And if you have a midterm election where the House changes exactly. or whatever, then suddenly your policy can change. That's too much instability.
It is too much instability. Exactly.
Luke, have we ever had this before, historically?
I mean, I think in a sense, all presidents govern during a time of crisis of some kind, whether political, cultural, social, military, and foreign policy. I think what's different about this era is that you can probably check all those boxes in some way. If you look at, call it the Trump-Biden era, And you know, I remember 20 years ago, I taught my first college class. This coming fall will be 20 years. And that was, again, another contentious presidential election. And for the younger ones in the room, that was President Bush's reelection against Senator Kerry. And I remember then, you know, the media already starting the narrative of this is the most divided we've ever been as a nation. I mean, we've heard that more than once. And, you know, so it was a great teaching moment for these 18 and 19-year-olds in my classroom to say, what do you think about that? Is that true? And sort of, you know, timidly at first, but then, you know, the hands started to go up and they said, what about the Civil War? Remember, Nixon's longtime speechwriter, Ray Price, was always fond of saying that if the 1860s was an actual Civil War, the 1960s was a proxy Civil War in a way. And as someone whose last book was on the 1968 presidential election, I think you probably have to go back to 68 in terms of another time period where you check, I would say, most or maybe even all of those boxes in terms of the crises.
And of course, Vietnam was among the major issues at that time.
Yep. And as much a foreign policy issue as a domestic policy issue because of the draft and the way that it tore apart college campuses.
See, yep. I was there.
How would you, let's just say if President Biden is reelected, how does that change foreign policy? And is it I assume most of you think it would be somewhat of an improvement over President Trump.
I would say just in general for, I would think the world, but certainly Asia, Biden seems to be more feared by the Chinese because of, again, the sort of rational approach. He's implementing some of the same trade policies the Trump administration had, but it's more targeted. It's more well thought out. It's without all the hyperbole. And the same goes for our allies in Asia. They prefer someone who's got a bit more of the consistency. Where we're coming up short is on the delivery, but at least in terms of rhetoric and kind of planning, the Biden administration, I think, would overall be more welcomed by our allies at a deeper level, more feared by those we consider adversaries, which China's interesting. It's a frenemy because we do so much with trade, but are so much at odds politically. At the same time, the Chinese also see in Trump what they see in their own leadership, right? It's nationalistic, bombastic, self-aggrandizing leadership. And so in that sense, they in some ways, I must say, maybe fear Trump a bit more, but that's more for the chaos than anything else. But yeah, I think the Biden administration overall would better serve our national interest in East Asia.
Let me play the devil's advocate on that one, just because I think you need to hear the other side of that, which is I agree when it comes to international alliances, when it comes to support of Ukraine, if you believe that's in our strategic national interest, that clearly, and NATO, clearly the Biden administration would be a more positive force. Having said that, our policy with Iran that has been supported by both the Obama administration and by the Biden administration has been problematic at best. We've tried to curry favor with the Iranians. We have tried to, for those who want to be real detractors, appease them. And we have seen that they're basically bad actors in that part of the world. And so a Trump administration presumably would not cozy up as much to Iran going forward. I think that would be a positive for the U.S. based upon what we have experienced so far. Hamas, Israel, I think, again, the Democratic Party is conflicted. It has a left-wing element of its party that is very pro-Palestine. And so to the extent that we believe that the weight of the argument is in favor of Israel in that part of the world, I think Trump would be better. So it relates to China. Again, we have to give the devil his due here. He was the one who clearly, I think, made a major issue of China, obviously not being the best partner, if you will, economically, and all the issues with respect to intellectual property rights and so on. So I think you have to give him credit for that. How that would play out in a second term, I'm not sure. So I think there would be some pluses. I think there would be some minuses, to be sure. I think on balance, those minuses, I would agree, probably outweigh the pluses. But there are some significant pluses.
Just real quickly to say, I would fully acknowledge what Ron was saying there about Trump did elevate the China issue. And he brought attention to it where there had always been this in economics, it's called the modernization theory, and the assumption that, well, as China's economy modernizes, it will liberalize politically and everything will be fine and we'll get along. And he called out that lie. To me, it's just a matter of implementation. The Biden administration has not deviated significantly from what Trump instigated.
True. I was just going to have one comment, too, along those lines. I read an editorial a few weeks ago in the Washington Post, which, as some of you know, is not the most pro-Trump place you can read in the media.
To say the least.
And I think it was fascinating. In some kind, I think they really put the finger on something that I never thought about, which was that as Americans, we've gotten better at understanding Trump in the sense that, you know, for 4 years, it took us 4 years to figure out, you know, you don't need to take the tweets literally. Just because he says something doesn't mean he's going to do that. I mean, it took a process to figure out that he's a different kind of politician. And so I think in the context of our discussion today, you know, to the extent that that observation is true at all, the question is, how have other nations learned to interpret him after 4 years? Is kind of the big answer. I recall in the Trump administration, the Europeans feeling pretty bruised and beat up at times. And I wonder, you know, the sentiment today in those foreign offices, have they also adapted and learned to interpret him differently? I suspect they have.
Good point.
Now, I just before we go to questions, I want to raise one other issue just to make things more complicated, which is now we have new technology that is really could transform elections, transform how elections are interpreted abroad. And Ashwin, we'll start with you. I mean, what is going to be the influence even this year of AI on international politics and our presidential politics?
I think it's a great question. I think we can only imagine what the impact of technology is likely to be on this election cycle, not just in this nation, but you know, I think 45 or 47% of the world's population is going to be voting this year in the course of 2024. There's like 54 countries that are lined up to vote. I think if you look back, the technology that's unifying all countries is also the same technology that is trying to create polarization within the countries, and that's the internet enablement of technology. And it's the cell phone, right? It's everybody's addiction. It's social media. We don't know any longer how to live without this tool in our hands. It's the first thing we look at when we wake up and the last thing we do before we go to bed. It's that addictive. And I was reading just the other day that the average citizen in the United States looks at their phone every 6 minutes on average, every 6 minutes. So if you're awake for 10 hours, you've looked at it 100 times. I don't think you look at anything 100 times. Not your dad, not your mom, not your wife, not your husband. No, but this damn thing is so addictive. And you need that one dopamine shot every 6 minutes to keep going. I think that social media interaction has now been cornered. I think we just need to admit that it has been cornered. They've become echo chambers. If I look at social media X, it's very unlikely, no matter what Ron tells me to do, that I'll look at social media Y. And if Ron is addicted to Y, he will never even attempt to look at X. And that is as true offline, on the air, for instance. You have your favorite channels for your news. You will only tune into those news channels because it reinforces your thoughts and your beliefs. You do not want to be informed about the other side, leave alone engage with the other side. So we've started to fight this end zone game where we shout at each other from each other's end zone. There's no meeting in the middle here, right? So now you superpose that with AI and deepfakes, and you have a public that wants to believe, that is not necessarily skeptical, but instead wants to believe what it is being fed. And you create deep fakes that are feeding those very beliefs that they want to now believe. We, I think, are going to see a crescendo of AI-enabled deep fakes this year that will make Taylor Swift, whatever, look like, ah, that was fun, right? That is a level of, I don't know what to call it. It is manipulation. It's manipulation, but it is dystopian that, you know, to think that we're going to elect our next leadership on on that background of dystopia is very frightening to me.
And I was going to add one comment and come at this a slightly different way, which is that if I recall, President Biden launched his reelection campaign with a social media video that was about 3 minutes in length. And we haven't gotten to this point yet, but I think we're close to it in this country where when you see a candidate speaking, you know, we're all producers of our own content. We all have devices that can upload content in moments while we're still here sitting in this room. When we see a video from a candidate and we say, how do we know that's authentic at a certain point? I mean, the AI is going to get that important. Yeah. And where a potential foreign leader could say something that could bring nations to the brink of war, potentially. And how do we know that's authentic? You know, and this is a space that I think government is hesitant to regulate, but knows it must step in at some point. But I think it's a real question, even going back to kind of the early World Wide Web days or something. You know, I don't know what role ICANN might have played in kind of authenticating certain websites and protocols and IP addresses. But I think we're nearing a point where we have to have a system to validate and authenticate online content, especially political content.
And it's transnational, of course.
Exactly. It's transnational. So there's a jurisdictional issue because content can be created by anybody, anywhere, and fed into any demographic that they choose to anywhere else in the world. And oh, by the way, all the laws of every land on the face of the earth only applies to the people who are lawful. These are not people who are lawful. They're fundamentally unlawful people who are doing this. So they don't care what laws we make.
Sure. I'm sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say that this is a challenge that presents a really interesting opportunity for cooperation internationally. This is an issue. Some of you have undoubtedly read this book by Mustafa Suleiman called The Coming Wave, which talks about the incredible changes that are underway and will take place because of the confluence of AI and synthetic biology, the greatest technological changes that mankind has ever seen are taking place and will take place. And the need for international cooperation to be able to deal with these issues is greater than anything that we have seen and important on a scale that we have never imagined. How that happens in a world in which, again, we're denigrating the value of international cooperation in many respects, or the ability of institutions to help mediate issues, is going to be a real challenge going forward. So I think, you know, we're going to need to have these institutions and these alliances much more to deal with what is both a fantastic opportunity for mankind and a great threat because of bad actors in particular who don't want to play within the system.
How ironic, isn't it, that at the same moment that we have this need is the same moment that many elected leaders are trying to take down the very systems that enable the need in the first place.
Now, just before we get to questions, which we open up in a couple minutes, just to get back to the TikTok issue, and obviously talk about bad actors, I think China does a good job of filling that role. What do you expect will be happening with AI and social media coming out of China, particularly as long as TikTok is having an impact? We know that TikTok has had a big impact on perceptions of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Where do you see that going, given the tremendous power that China has?
Well, I'll quickly take the part on China there, and that is, I think, exactly to the points being made. I mean, this is an incredible opportunity for cooperation. Unfortunately, China's basic stance is, I want to get my way, and then we can talk about things like cooperation, whether it's on climate change or regarding, like, they don't even want to have for example, famously, they were refusing any sort of top-level military-to-military communication because they prefer to keep the U.S. on edge. And so they've increased gray zone activity around Taiwan and so forth. And how that relates to AI is, this is obviously an area, just like Ron was mentioning, where we should be cooperating. We could cooperate for the benefit of everyone, including they themselves. But they... China is particularly tricky because you've got an authoritarianly administered, digitally savvy. I mean, this is a surveillance state. And so it has also hacking groups, technically non-state actors that are contracted out by the People's Liberation Army. And we've been engaging with a kind of cyber warfare with them for years. So I'm a little bit more concerned about that. And one of the lessons of like 2016 is, you know, it one of the it seems swing factors could have been a tweet that was allegedly from the Pope supporting Donald Trump. that's simple by today's standards, right? That was just you know, some troll factory in Moscow generating that. But China's learned. China it kind of stayed out of 2016. It could very much get involved, and it can be like Ashwin was sort of talking about. I mean, this more dystopian, you know, type of altered reality. I think of what, you know, QAnon fevered dreams rendered as a deep fake. I mean, and you'd have fanaticized followers who have already shown they'll go to pizza parlors with weapons ready to kill people. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway, I China could be a great solver of this problem working together with the U.S. In fact, if the U.S. and China got together, it could solve it, I think. I just don't see the will from at least China's side too much along the terms of what we're looking for.
You're not betting the family fortune on it, that's for sure.
No, unfortunately, yeah. And yet it could be. And maybe this is also something for us to look forward to. Eventually, there will be a post-Xi administration,
yeah,
just like there was a post-Mao administration. And post-Mao was really good, really good times for U.S.-China relations. Maybe that'll happen, but who knows how long, you know, Xi Jinping will remain in power and be the guy deciding everything there.
We're going to continue the discussion. But
well, and now what we'd like to do is encourage our audience to come up. If you'd like to ask a question, kind of queue up over here. And any questions that you'd like to ask are fair game. I'd like to start us off with one, which is that we've been talking a lot about national security issues. We've been talking about state-to-state relations and alliances. What about the theme of environmentalism? This has been something that's on, it's in the zeitgeist of the world. It's on the minds of many younger people, especially younger voters in the United States, and obviously requires a great deal of international cooperation to pull off. How do you think that will play into either the Biden or the Trump agenda for foreign policy in this upcoming election cycle? And again, for people who want to ask questions, come on over here.
Wow. You know, for me, the climate problem is a very interesting one because anybody on the face of the earth will likely say, I did not create the problem. But everybody on the face of the earth will probably say, I need to do something about it. The problem is that there is no clarity about what it is that we are being asked to do about it. You know, we tend to look at everything exogenous to our own lives and say, oh, it's the number of trucks that are on the road. It's the amount of coal fuel that gets used to generate power. It's always somebody else's problem. So at a corporate level, I often look at net neutrality being set as a goal from an environmental social perspective. But I also look at carbon credits being offered where people can buy carbon credits to claim net neutrality. These are all distortions that are market-driven but are being embraced in order to lay claim to something that is false, is not really helping, but looks, the optics look like something is being done. So this, if anything, to me, is a very personal issue, right? Where everybody, every person has to commit to doing something that is different tomorrow than from yesterday and today, so that net, we are doing something good for the environment by saying, I will not, and therefore hold true to that line. That's where I sort of bottom out on this. It's not somebody else's problem. It's my problem.
But I'm just wondering if, in terms of foreign policy, obviously, you have the issue of China being a huge emitter, India, a fast-growing emitter. How does an American president deal with things that are, I mean, we've been declining our GHG significantly. What can a president do or should do? Should he just say, well, we're going to take care of it by inflicting pain on our citizens? Or is there some solution to this? Maybe, Ron, it's some form of international cooperation, which we don't seem to be very good at.
Well, we have had mechanisms to do that. Obviously, President Trump took us out of the Paris Climate Accords.
So, again, there are ways to try to address the issue. The question always is, are those mostly for window dressing ultimately? What concrete impact do they really have? Is mitigation an alternative? It hasn't been an alternative effectively in the Democratic Party. There's a great book, again, which I highly commend, called Unsettled by Stephen Koonin, yeah, in which he essentially writes about the fact, brilliant a physicist and a member of the Obama administration, and he basically said the climate issue is an issue, but is substantially not the same as the narrative that we hear today. And I think that is the question separating the narrative from the realities and what we can do to affect the realities.
How does this affect the relationship with China? I mean, China seems to be playing a really good game of pushing such things, let's say, as EVs,
yeah,
using coal to build them,
yep,
and then essentially having an enormous market opportunity in both Europe and the U.S. Is China just playing a cynical game here? Or?
I would say that if you look also before EVs, solar panels, right? So also to be fair within context to China, this is known as an East Asian development strategy. We actually saw this with Japan, with semiconductors, when memory chips were more of a thing. We had a whole, we finally embraced industrial policy in the 1990s by basically saying we were going to have a semiconductor agreement with Japan. We had quotas on Japanese cars, you know, and then, you know, Japan went through a bubble economy where they were no longer an economic threat, and then attention turned to places like South Korea. Then once China rose up, using a similar method, mercantilistic, where they suppress imports and promote exports through subsidies and so forth, and then they build a big industry, whether it's in solar panels or EVs, and then they have this huge both internal market and export engine, and then they can use that to their advantage. And then it becomes a political issue. So Europe, the United States are both trying to counteract what they see as dumping of Chinese now EVs, but before it was solar panels. So yeah, it is kind of cynical. At the same time, you can't deny that China is on the right side of history when it comes to converting to sustainable energy forms. One of the stark realities China faced is it has to import all its energy needs, or it uses dirty burning coal. So they embrace the move to EVs. I remember visiting during the G20 in Hangzhou, a Geely facility, which is a Hangzhou-based car company, the owner of Volvo now. And they were talking about how they were going to be making this big transition to EVs. And I thought, yeah, you know, I know you're touting the government line. I didn't really believe it. And they've been making those targets. I mean, there are a lot of things China isn't making. The data should be suspect. But in the case of EVs, no, they saw this as an absolute national threat. They also see the relation to a data-driven economy. And anyway, they fully embraced it. And they are ahead of the U.S., certainly, in terms of creating the world's largest EV market, both domestically and as an export market.
Steve?
Hey, first, congratulations. This is a great panel here. I mean, I could talk to you guys for hours. What are you doing for dinner afterwards, or maybe a weekend in Tahoe? My goodness, great
minds.
Let's
do it.
Two questions. One kind of focuses on what you've been talking about already in terms of China. I'm noticing or reading quite a bit about the internal corrosion of the economy. It's been alluded to by some of the comments made already. What I wonder to myself is, with if this corrosion continues, if there's more unrest internally, does this make China a passive tiger or a hungry tiger in terms of the world stage? Second question, I'll go for the bonus one right away, is what effect do the rogue states have in terms of being a trigger point? Study history, think about Sarajevo, think about the idea of North Korea. If the if it's to be believed, they're getting to the next step in terms of their nuclear capability in Iran, again, mentioned again. What could these be flashpoints in terms of instability? Thanks.
I'll take the China one just real quickly and invite others to also comment. But to say my own assessment is that a deflated China, and it is actually going through deflation now economically. And also, it seems, despite the rhetoric that just came out of the two sessions, which concluded on Sunday, which is their big annual political meeting, although Xi Jinping continues to see or express of China being on the rise and the West on a descent, in fact, I think as reality hits, they realize the risk of engaging the West more aggressively, and that would include an invasion of Taiwan. So I think it would actually minimize the issue. However, I think it was on a previous podcast with Joel and Marshall that I mentioned there's also, though, the Falkland scenario, which is, you know, so Argentina, you know, the junta is falling out of favor. And it's like, hey, let's go create a war, you know, distract the people, rally the troops. And it was a disaster for them. I hope China would learn a bit from history with that. But there is that real danger. So I can't say it's a probability, you know, it's close to zero as I would like. It's less than 50 percent, I think, but it's still a real enough possibility. And part of it could be like if Xi Jinping feels his power is really slipping him because you have one key decision maker and that's it. If he thinks he absolutely needs this for his political or even maybe physical survival, it certainly the risk would raise.
And as you said earlier, a lot of it depends upon who his successor is.
Yeah.
If it's a Deng Xiaoping equivalent, that would bode probably well.
Wow, that's right.
Vis-a-vis, you know, what went before in terms of Mao, or if it's a Boris Yeltsin, or if it's a Mikhail Gorbachev in Russia, it bodes well after Putin. I guess the question is, will the extant circumstances in China favor the arrival, if you will, of a successor more along the lines of Xi, or more along the lines of Deng Xiaoping? And I don't have the knowledge base to be able to make that assessment. What's your sense for that? Who do we get?
Well, I would say that I like to think that, again, China is an incredibly historic country. One of the things I always like to point out when I first talk about China culturally is it's the only civilization I'm aware of that can read ancient text in the original. So six-year-old kids in China study Confucius. That's from, you know, 2,500 years ago. No, 2,700 years ago. Wow, it's even further. Yeah, it's 500 BCE. So yeah, 2,700. So nearly 3,000 years ago, I mean, kids, before they can really compose persuasive essays, read that text. And Greeks, for example, cannot read Plato in the original. They need to have it, you know, updated. Or Italians, you know, you can't read, you know, Italian, right? Yeah. Ancient Latin, right? Think about us. I mean, we need liner notes for reading Shakespeare, right? Yeah. So you know, that's considered modern English, by the way. Yeah. So my point, and by the way, so part of that is not just Confucius, which, by the way, Confucius, although the Chinese Communist Party has really tried to, with the Confucian Institutes and so forth, spin that in a nationalistic, pro-authoritarian vein. It's actually in a similar vein to Taoism and parts of Buddhism. It is more meditative. It's more emphasizing self-improvement, and it has a lot of positive features that are non-aggressive. And then they also love to study ancient history. In ancient history, so Deng Xiaoping is famous, among other quotes, for one that comes up a lot in terms of geopolitics. Hide one's sword and bide one's time. And they can be interpreted in different ways, but basically means, you know, stay chill, right? Do not act rashly. So in terms of Ron's question, I would say if the successor continues with that more rational tradition, moreover, to the point that China is now so leveraged in the global economy, Ashwin actually made the point very aptly, I think, look, it is not in China's interest to go into Taiwan because it would lose what it still needs, which is access to microchips and the global supply chain, which if nothing else, even if the U.S. doesn't engage in active warfare with China, there's no way the U.S. would sit by and allow the flow of goods to keep moving. I mean, they've already been restricted. It would be restricted more. We would lean on more of our allies to really isolate China. And that would just be a disaster for whoever follows. So I think that hopefully the lessons from history will be for whoever the successor is to just, you know, take care of things at home. The status quo with Taiwan has actually worked for China. Mm-hmm. And if they keep that in mind, whatever the rhetoric is, a bit like what we were talking about regarding Trump. You know, he can say one thing and then people get used to understanding him in another way. I hope that will apply for China. At least that's my guess.
I would like to take one last question and then we'll wrap up getting comments from all of you. So please.
Awesome. Thank you. Hi, my name is Haley Bunzeld. I'm a junior sociology student at Chapman. Something that I'm noticing in the key areas that you guys are talking about is a lack of critical education in the American population. You speak of this plant in Phoenix that lacks 4,000 people to staff it. I mean, that's less than the undergraduate population of Chapman University. I'm wondering what sort of education models there might be abroad or historically of nations that have successfully educated large masses of their population to be able to move into this next wave of kind of liberalization that we're experiencing in the world?
That's a great question. I just have to say that the example that pops in my mind is Japan in the 1880s. Rob?
Yeah. Rob, right? Rob. Okay. Japan, Japan definitely. Although, see, one of the tricky things with so you could go down the line similarly to what I was talking about with East Asia development strategies. So Japan and then the ASEAN as well. That's right. They've all. I mean, it used to be referred to. You heard this a lot in the 90s. The Confucian work ethic, right? Which also stresses education. So China, in that regard, too, is a later inheritor of what Japan proved was successful. And in between, you've got South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, ASEAN countries, indeed. I think this is it. You know, the question was about liberalized economy. And the juncture they're at, and you really see this with China, is, well, what about creative industries? We had this discussion over lunch. You know, Korea has done quite good with that, but they had to make a real hard effort to create the K-wave in K-pop. And even then, what is K-pop? I mean, apologies to any fans of BTS. It's very regimented, right? It is very synchronized. It is very manufactured. I mean, for those of us who like maybe more independent styles of music, it's kind of corporate rock to the extreme.
It's like EDM.
Right, there you go. Well, you could have different arguments about EDM, but fair enough. Good point. So I would say this is yes to that. I mean, Japan and other countries have been very good at it. It's also what's referred to as catch-up economics. You know, for countries right. that lost out on the Industrial Revolution, which was localized around the Western economies, East Asian economies have done really good at catching up. But then it's when you reach that same level, that kind of middle income development state, how do you go beyond that? And this is where, in particular, I'll just make a final comment. China is especially thwarted because it's adopted a surveillance state model, because it's emphasizing rote education, because it demands obedience to a single party and a single leader. And basically North Korea are the least adept at really taking things to the next level. I mean, you're kind of independent and creative in China on the side. The government talks about innovation, but it is by no means setting up the system for that. And even Japan, which is still largely an open society by comparison, has also struggled with that because of the formulaic approach it takes to education.
So, what should we be doing?
Yeah, I would add a couple of flavors to what he said. I think there is the fundamental layer of education in terms of science, technology, engineering. Why do I say that? Because as a society, as an economy, we are dominated with industries that are born from science, technology, and engineering. We're not a Renaissance society in the 18th century in Europe where art was the means of growth. We are a science as a means of growth economy. On top of that, when you talk of the liberal term, it's the ability to imagine and innovate. That sets us apart. Much of the wealth that we've created, I mean, think about it. Since ChatGPT 3.5 was released 15 months ago, we've added $10.7 trillion to the market cap of the top seven companies alone. That's a level of wealth creation that we have not ever experienced, right, in such a short period of time. That's what we are capable of as this economy, where we combine STEM with imagination, creativity, innovation, and the market supports it, and the market then says, this is great, bring it on. Next tidal wave, please. We don't have too many other societies that give you those kind of opportunities. But foreseeing that and being prepared to take advantage of it, there are very few who are capable of doing, including ourselves. I mean, this is as much of an accident as it's an engineered outcome that we're having. And the fact that we now want to reshore some of the more critical elements of our supply chain is coming as a surprise to ourselves. Mm-hmm. This is the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. The policy was not in sync with reality. The policy suddenly got the right side of reality, but the reality of education was not ready for that. So that's so there's a supply chain gap here. It's a lagging factor. It's not that it won't ever catch up, but it'll take 10 years to catch up. The question is whether 10 years is good enough, which goes back to the foreign policy with Taiwan. So if you ask me, I say use the 10 years to create the 4,000 people. For the next 10 years, keep talking to China.
No choice.
Well, I just want to mention one last thing about Europe, because we've sort of left Europe for the Pacific Ocean. But basically, I'm not worried about the ability of the U.S. to survive a period of Donald Trump as it relates to its relationships with Europe. As was mentioned earlier by Rob, we have too many layers of contact and interaction with Europe, whether it's economic, foreign direct investment, tourism, people-to-people relationships, civil society linkages. There was a period of time during the second Bush administration where Jacques Chirac, who was the head of France, and Schroeder, who was the head of Germany, they had such animus toward Bush, they didn't even have a relationship. Hmm. Obviously, we survived that whole period. Chirac went to jail because of corruption, and Schroeder went to Gazprom to become a stoolie of the Russians. But that's another matter. But it's interesting, because I'm not worried about the ability of the relationship to survive. What I am worried about, and I've been worried about this for a long time, is the ability of Europe to remain relevant, and especially in relationship to the West. The pivot to the West is taking place for clear reasons, not the least of which is the economic dynamism of that part of the world. And when you put Europe and economic dynamism in the same sentence, it doesn't breed well. So I'm just concerned that with demographic issues, with immigration issues, with a political system which is cumbersome at best, I worry 25 years from now, Europe will not be as relevant as it is today and will not be as good a partner for the United States because of that. And we will therefore almost need to have that pivot to the West become incredibly, incredibly successful.
These are great comments. I'd like to leave the last one just because, you know, we are a university. We are supposed to be helping with this problem as opposed to hurting. Luke, what can we do at Chapman? What changes do we need to make that might lead us to at least addressing some of the issues that everyone's been bringing up in terms of education?
Well, I can certainly wish I could say after 90 minutes that I have all the answers right here in my pocket. But I do want to applaud the question. It was a good question, one of the best ones. And that came from a student who's thinking deeply about the right issues is impressive. But yeah, to your point, we're at Chapman. We're at an academic institution. Let's focus on this country. You know, what do we do about it? And I think there are a lot of people at Chapman from different fields who are beginning to have conversations about where do we go from here. You know, what does our structure need to look like? What do our degree programs need to look like? Centers, colleges, majors, and courses. You know, I think we come from different places, but we have overall the same mission, which is we have a duty to prepare the next generation for the challenges of that generation, and we need to anticipate what those are today. We can't wait until then. And so I think both within presidential studies, I think certainly you would agree in the Center for Demographics and Policy and other places, Smith Institute, others around campus, there are people having conversations to figure out how do we address this challenge going forward. Myself being a historian, and of course we all have a bias towards our own fields, is, you know, for the lifetime of my students, we have been so focused on a STEM society, science, technology, engineering, and math. Not to say those aren't important. My 9-year-old daughter loves every one of those fields more than she loves history, in fact. Mm. And that's perfectly fine with me. But the fact is, I think to succeed in the future world, we really do have to be good at everything all the time. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder personally whether the pendulum's gone too far towards STEM. And what that's meant is too many optional boxes for students who don't know their history, who don't know what American institutions are, who don't know what acceptable political behavior in Washington, even if we don't see many good examples of it, what it should be. And so I think there needs to be a recalibration, and I think that recalibration is occurring here.
Well, thank you, panelists. Yeah. Audience, thank you very much. This was just a fabulous session.
Thank our moderators.
Having you tune in to our future podcasts on the upcoming 2024 election, and thank you for joining us for the Feudal Future podcast.
The Feudal Future.